We want to welcome everyone who's ready the second share of our summer learning program. We thank, first of all, Rabbi Shai Shachter for putting together this wonderful program that you literally have programmed different special programs throughout the week. What we try to do with Sunday morning is to offer the community, aside from Rabbi Shachter's share that he's giving in terms of Torah personalities, but also an opportunity for us to hear and to focus on issues surrounding kashrus. Obviously something that's very, very present in our daily life, in our, as being a kosher consumer. And so we turn to the OU for their help in putting together this program. And this morning we have Rabbi Eli Gerstein, who's in charge of halachic policy, of organizing the halachic policy of the OU. So you can imagine all the different types of foods that are produced under the OU Hashkafa require all different types of halachic policies and guidelines. And so he's here this morning to share his expertise in this area. It's a tremendous opportunity for us to have Rabbi Gerstein with us. We thank you for taking your time this morning. Two bridges on the Sunday. We appreciate the efforts. The Schar Halicha, but we look forward to the Schar of hearing your words this morning.
Thank you very much. Warm introduction. Very close to be here. Share some of the insights from the OU for the community. I was asked to speak on the topic of kashrus in the workplace. If I was to try to quantify what exactly kashrus in the workplace is, as opposed to kashrus in the home. Kashrus is kashrus. It's kosher everywhere. What's the difference kashrus in the workplace? I would say it's kashrus b'dieved or difficult situations, I guess would be a good way to explain it. In our own homes, we do things l'chatchilo. We buy the foods that have on it the proper hachsherim. We keep a separate milchik, sepleishik sink. Separate microwaves, separate ovens, whatever we do in our own homes, we have our own protocol of what standard we keep. And then that's all turned on its head when we come into our workplace. Depending on where you work, even in the OU, we don't have a kosher microwave. You know, of all places, you think, you know, so, but no, the truth is we don't. There are a lot of non-Jewish workers, and there's no way, unless we kept the mashkiach, you know, sitting right next to the microwave the whole time, there's no way to keep them, there's no way to keep it kosher. Everybody has access to it, and people can bring in anything they want, milk, insulation, strafe, you know, anything can go into it. So we all have this, you know, share the same challenges of how do we keep kosher when we are at work, and we shouldn't be naive to think that, it's all probably fine, and someone else is looking after it, and there's other kosher people, and they use the microwave, or they use the fridge, and they use the sink, and it must be all okay. It's something that's worth looking into and getting a, you know, sort of a behind-the-scenes look of what exactly the issues are and we should be aware of. And if we see someone else doing something incorrectly, maybe we could also let them know what the proper behavior is. I was reminded, I was thinking of what I was going to speak about. I was reminded of a story someone told me recently about their experience in the workplace. They work in an office with a lot of non-Jews, and they have projects they work on, and at the end of every project, they go out for lunch together to celebrate. So it's a common thing. Every few weeks, they get together for lunch, and they go to a trefa restaurant. And this, of course, will discuss, you know, issues of going into a trefa restaurant, Marisayan, and is there anything that you can get at a trefa restaurant? Is there anything that you can order there? What do? You just sit there, you know, looking stupid, you know, sipping your Coke. So the workers understand that he keeps kosher, and they feel bad for him. They say, you know, okay, tell us, where can we go that is a kosher? And maybe, you know, we'll fit it into the schedule. So, you know, he tells them, yeah, there are some kosher restaurants in the neighborhood. There's one over here on this street, one on that street. You know, he tells them, he gives them a list of the different places. You know, a few weeks go by, and then finally one day they say to him, we're going out to eat. We're going out for lunch. We made reservations already. It's all set. And we're going out to such and such a restaurant. Of course, it was a Sarbat Avis, I think. You know, so now how do you explain to them? They, you know, you can't win, right? So Okay, but that's what it's like to be, you know, to work in a non-Jewish world, is that we, you know, we have to live with these situations. We have to be, you know, we have to have our rabbi's phone numbers on speed dial, and we have to we walk into a. We're going to have situations all the time that come up, and we, you know, exactly what to do. You know, we need to get answers. Well, let me just start. We started off with the issue of a microwave. Let me just discuss a microwave for a minute or two. In a workplace, one should generally assume, unless they have a very special situation where it's all from people and everybody, you know, everybody's careful, everyone knows, and everyone has the same standards. Otherwise, basically, everyone should assume that the microwave at work, as opposed to the microwave at home. Which is the one at work is Treif. Now, that being said, that doesn't mean there's no way to use a microwave. A microwave, if your food is double wrapped, that's the middle of what double wrap means. If you double wrap your food, so it's sort of like the airline meal type of idea, where your food comes double wrapped, then you could use the microwave because nothing from the microwave will penetrate into your food. Now, what does it mean to be double wrapped? If you try taking a coffee and double wrapping it and putting it in your microwave, you're going to have a big explosion at the end. It's not going to work. So the idea of double wrapping food is that you want that the issue is that when you cook food in a microwave, it produces steam. It produces what we can, halacha, we call it, referred to as zeya. But in English, we could call it steam. And the steam fills up the microwave. And if we would have taken, put this into Yoredeya terms, into Shulchan Aruch terms, it's like what Shulchan Aruch would describe. If I took a cover from a pot top, I took a pot top cover, I placed it on top of my pot. So if you picture the microwave as being, let's say, a large pot, I put a small pot inside of it with my noodles and my cheese or my coffee or whatever it is, and I take a cover and I place it on top of it, and when I cook up the food inside the microwave, basically what I'm doing is, the steam goes up, and I have a non-kosher cover sitting on top of my pot. Now, of course, if this would happen in someone's home, they would recognize right away, this is a problem. I take a milchik, a pot cover, and put it on top of my pot. So I call the rabbi. If I took a treifa pot cover, I placed it over my pot, I have a problem. So how do I put my bowl of, let's say I brought with me to work a bowl of noodles, and I want to warm it up in my microwave. So the simple answer is you take a kosher pot cover and place it on top. I take a layer of saran wrap and I cover over the bowl. So now I have a kosher cover on top, and the rest of the microwave I can sort of ignore. So why do we say you should double wrap it? Really, that should be sufficient. Problem is that there could be other things in the microwave. Microwaves aren't always cleaned out properly. There could be little bits of food particles inside the microwave, which themselves can produce zeya. And then we end up with a situation where I have zeya coming up against the plastic cover on the bottom, and I have zeya filling the microwave on the other side, and that also causes a problem. That's also considered an inappropriate contact with the non-kosher food. So what we do is we then put it inside of a second wrapping. We put a paper bag or something around it. So if you're having that type of situation, then there can't be any. There's no problem. Now, the obvious question is, well, if I try doing this, if I take the plastic wrap, or even if I take a Tupperware cover and I place it on top of my bowl, it probably is going to pop. The pressure is going to build up. Maybe if I do it for 10 seconds, I'll be okay. But if I really want to get it warmed up, it's gonna explode. So what you have to do is you have to make holes in the wrapping, in either the Tupperware cover or in the sometimes they have vents in them if you have a microwavable one, or if I put a plastic wrapping on it, you'll have to make holes, little slits in the plastic so that it can vent out. But now I've ran into the problem again. If I have vents in it and the steam gets now through the microwave, so I've ruined it again. So the answer to that is that this is what Lebowski Tzatzal held, and Yibol Chaim Tovim Rav Shachter is the Herschel Schechter, that is the Posek Vdiyu, they both held that if you have small slits in the plastic, it is not a problem. It allows the venting of the steam out of the bag, but it does not allow steam to penetrate back into the bag. It won't come in against the pressure. What's coming out will not allow any droplets of moisture to come back in. So you have to make small holes in the plastic. If you rip open the plastic, you make a large opening, then you'd have a problem. Things could drip back in. But if you have small holes, it can release the pressure and it won't allow anything to come back in. And that should, again, it should be placed into a double seal. So you have this plastic cover around it, and then you can put it into a plastic bag, you can put it into a brown bag. It does not have to be airtight, the second bag. It just has to be some sort of a general cover around it. And in this manner, you could then use the non-kosher microwave. I would contrast this, though, we'll see in a second, to a toaster oven. Okay, so you would think a toaster oven, probably I could do the same type of thing. If I have a non-kosher toaster oven in the work, I want to, you know, have a pizza or something, maybe it tastes better if I put it into a toaster oven, it browns better, it tastes better. So I'll take aluminum foil. I'll take two layers of aluminum foil, I'll wrap around the pizza, and I'll put it in there. What could be the problem? But there's another halacha, which people aren't so aware of, especially at work. They might not be thinking in this context, which is there's a problem of cooking basar b'chalav. Okay, not allowed to cook basar b'chalav. That's, everyone knows that. That's not only can you not eat basar b'chalav, but you can't cook it. Toaster ovens are often used by the non-Jews in the office to cook all their foods, including their lasagna, which has in it meat and cheese, or their pizza, which has on it meats. A lot of the non-Jewish foods, you'd be surprised, and to us, we think of meat and cheese, whatever, you know, we never think of it. A lot of the non-kosher foods are actually basar b'chalav. They're mixtures of meat and milk. And non-Jew heats up his food, his hamburger, his steak with cheese on it, his whatever it is in the toaster oven. And there are little bits of food that fall to the bottom of the toaster. When a person turns on the toaster oven, they are going to be heating up that food again. And that is a problem of cooking basar b'chalav. Rama in Yoredeya discusses this very question. He talks about if there's a non-Jew who works in your house, say you have some sort of a maid, and they have their own pots and their own utensils that they work with, and they place their pot on top of your stove to cook, okay, not such a problem. You know, they're not going to drip over, they're not going to, they'll all stay dry, whatever the context is. We're probably talking about in their old style where you hung the pot over the, you know, over some sort of a fireplace to cook. Question is, can you stir the pot? The non-Jew goes out for a minute and says to you, you know, my soup is cooking over here. Can you make sure it doesn't burn? Am I permitted to stir the pot? And I see what they're cooking in my house. I didn't put any milk in the pot. They're cooking only a vegetable soup. Well, kosher ingredients, they cut it up all of my, using my, utensils. Everything's kosher, but they put it into their pot. They have their own pot, which they bring with them to work, which they're going to cook their soup in. And the Rama says, you can't stir that pot. You can't stoke the fire underneath it while that pot is cooking. Because that pot was used most probably for basar b'chalav. When they took it home last night or this morning or before they came, very likely they might have cooked in it meat and milk together. And if you stir the pot, you are actually helping to cook meat and milk, because the meat and the milk that is absorbed inside the pot will go into the, goes, gives taste into the food, and it is a violation of cooking basar b'chalav. So that same concern applies over here as well. If a person turns on a toaster oven, or let's say a non-Jew asks them, could you heat up for me this food in the toaster oven? That's something that people might not be thinking of cooking basar b'chalav. That, even if I know what I'm cooking here, I'm just heating up a piece of toast or something for them. This might be a concern, unless one were to wipe out the toaster oven in some way to clean it out from you know how dirty they can get. In a microwave, this is less of a problem, because usually when you turn on a microwave, it does not get hot. The only part of the microwave that gets hot is the bowl of food that you put in it. If you feel the walls of the microwave, you'll see that it generally doesn't get hot. There's another reason why microwaves are less of a problem. That is because it's a whole question whether cooking with microwaves is considered vishal at all. There's a discussion for, not so relevant, but discussion on Shabbos. Are you allowed to cook with a microwave? The other problem is using electricity, and there's a light bulb that goes on inside the microwave, all types of other issues. But just in terms of the cooking, if you sort of ignore the other aspects, and we could somehow circumvent them, I have a microwave on a Shabbos clock, and whatever way you get around the other issues of the microwave, just in terms of the cooking of it, is that considered cooking? So for Shabbos, if a person cooks in the sun, let's say a person puts his food outside in the sunlight and it cooks, that's not considered a method of cooking. It's permitted on Shabbos to put food outside, even if it's a very hot day. And I heard in Arizona the other day it was over 120 degrees. You know, maybe you considered the answer lettuce bowl. A person would be permitted to place an egg outside, even though you could cook it with the chama. Cook in the chama. Toldos chama, which means something which is, you have a, let's say, the hood of a car that gets heated by the sun or inside of the car. You know, they say, never leave your children in a car. It could get, you know, extremely hot because of the sun rays inside. Becomes like a, but you know how hot it can get inside of a automobile. But that's all, that would be, I mean, actually might be chama itself. That might not even be a toldos chama. But let's say the hood of a car would be, let's say, like a toldos chama. It gets heated up, it absorbs the sun rays, and then you use that to cook. So that's on Shabbos, that's an issur d'rabbanan. In certain circumstances, though, it's permitted. For a chayla, for certain situations, it's permitted to use these methods. So the question is, what about a microwave? What type of cooking is that? Is that the type of cooking that's forbidden on Shabbos or not? That's a machlokes. There's different opinions. Igros Moshe and Moshe Feinstein held that it would be a deraisa type of cooking. It would be a Torah prohibition to cook with microwaves. And his explanation was because it's a normal way of cooking. And for Shabbos, we go with what's normal, the normal method of cooking. For basar b'cholov, is that considered a method of cooking that would be min haTorah aser? Is it only d'rabbanan? Is it not at all? There is no d'rabbanan for basar b'cholov, really. So is it permitted, not permitted? Question. Okay, it's not so clear whether you person's permitted to cook. I wouldn't recommend it, cooking basar b'cholov in a microwave. But again, when it comes to this question of the microwave doesn't really get hot, the food inside, the crumbs, so it's generally accepted that it's permitted. You're allowed to use a non-kosher microwave, you double round up the food, you put it in, it's fine. Comes to other types of cooking, though, it's more questionable. A toaster oven, where it uses a regular conventional heating element, which we consider to be an ash, consider to be a fire. So it's better not to. If a person had to heat up something in it, one method would be to ask a non-Jew to do it for you. Okay, a person gets an airline meal. They're probably not using a microwave on the airline. They're probably using some sort of a heated, convection, heating, whatever, some sort of a heater in the oven. And that's not a problem. It's double wrapped. The non-Jew does it for me. I didn't cook the basar b'cholov. They did it. Even though you're not allowed to ask a non-Jew to cook basar b'cholov for you either, here, this type of situation is considered that you're not asking him to do that. This is it's just something that happens, a side thing that happens. You're asking him to cook the food for you, which is just to heat up the pizza. If he turns on the toaster and it also cooks basar b'cholov at the same time, that's not what you requested him to do. That would be permitted. Similar on Shabbos, we have similar cases like that where you ask the non-Jew to do one activity, even though the second activity, you ask him to open the refrigerator, a light bulb goes on. It's considered what we call psik resha. It's only something that's not the primary intent. It's a secondary intent. So that's not a problem. Okay, so, but in terms of, again, in terms of heating up food in the microwave, the postgame of the OU hold that you should, in fact, make holes in the plastic. Otherwise, you're going to end up with the plastic popping, and then you won't end up with any cover at all, and then end up with the speed dial problem that we mentioned before. You have to call the rabbi. But you should have two covers. You should have a plastic, some sort of a saran wrap or plastic bag that you make slits in, make small holes, and it should be put into a second bag, like a paper bag or the box or something that should be a second cover on it as well. Another common issue in a workplace setting is a coffee machine. Coffee machines we could divide, I guess, into several different types of machines. There's just your plain hot water urn, okay, where they give you a little thing of instant coffee and you make your own drink or whatever, and there's just a hot water urn there. Well, one problem, you know, in the New York area, we have New York City, we have a question with the is the water filtered or not? For those who are careful about the New York City water, the copepods and which are little tiny bugs in the water, so that's something that should be a person should be alert to. What is the source of the water in this hot water urn? is it filtered water or not? If the machine has its own, 5 gallon canister of Poland Spring, so then obviously it's not a problem. A lot of machines will have run off of city water, but they'll have a filter on them. You could check the machine. You could see if you really see it. It looks like a canister on the hooked up to the water line. And if it has a filter on it, then it's not a problem. Then we get asked all the time in the OU, what exactly is the size of the filter that you need? If it has a filter, basically it's not going to be a problem, because the copepods that we're concerned about are the ones that are large enough that you can see them with your naked eye, which means they're quite large. If there's any filter on the machine, it's going to be screening things much, much smaller than something which is visible to the eye. So they're usually taking out things that are invisible even, and things that are different heavy metals or different, all different types of impurities in the water that they're concerned about, which is why they're filtering. And therefore, it's going to remove certainly anything visible, certainly the copepods will be removed as well. But if a person wants a number, in the OU we say if it's less than, if it's a filter of 50 microns or smaller, that would already be a size that is certainly appropriate. And it's not visible and it's not a problem. So let's assume it has a filter on it. Do we have to be concerned that the hot water urn was used for people put their mugs by it, took coffee or took soups or something? They made something non kosher using their thing. Was the opinion of Rebelsky Zatzal that you could use a hot water urn in an office or any else place you are? A person staying is at a car mechanic and they have a hot water urn over there. A person's traveling somewhere, they're having a meeting, and someone sets up a hot water urn. A hot water urn generally is acceptable. He was not concerned about people taking soups and such from the urn, even though that, of course, does happen. It's not that he didn't think it happens, but rather the explanation is because the water coming out of the urn is what we refer to as an irui. It's a flow of water out of the urn. When it goes into the cup or bowl, whatever it's going to go into, that's called a kli sheni. Okay, it's a secondary vessel. Just like on Shabbos, we know a kli sheni is much more lenient. We're not so concerned about putting foods into a kli sheni on Shabbos as we are about putting foods into the urn itself, the kli rishon or the iri kli rishon, the flow from the urn. So once it goes into a kli sheni already, so the person has his tray for soup and he soup mix or whatever it is, and he takes the water and he pours it on, that already is what's called a The soup itself is now in a kli sheni. The steam that comes back up from that is the zeya from the kli sheni, does not affect the urn. Okay, that's a very brief explanation of it. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but that's the in a nutshell idea of why the urn is not a problem. What about people bring up the concern that if a person holds their soup or their mug too high? They don't put it down below, but sometimes people will hold it up and it'll actually touch into the nozzle of the urn itself. Isn't that a concern? Don't have to be concerned that someone did that. And he used to say that no, you don't have to be concerned. Again, there are various Yoridea explanations for why this is not a big deal. Again, it has to do with the cliche and the way it goes down, it comes back up, and etc. But he held it was not such a concern. What could be done, though, if a person wants to be a little more careful, is that they can let out a little bit of hot water first from the urn before they take their coffee or before they take their cup of hot water. So if they let out a little bit, or they took first a cup and put a few ounces of hot water in it, discarded that water, then took their cup of coffee. That would be the most that if someone wants to be extra careful, that's the most that would be required of them to do. Again, like I started off, this is Yoridea in difficult situations. In one's own home, if this happened, this is not necessarily the way to do it. But in a work setting, this is fine. If this is a person wants to have a drink, they're allowed to. And even in the Shulchan Aruch itself gives many examples of when a person is away from home, a person's in a non-Jewish environment, a lot of leniencies of what is permitted. So one shouldn't derive from what I'm saying, that this is what I would do in what one should do in their own home as well. This is meant for a workplace or a non-Jewish setting of what is permitted. So again, one could take water from those type of urns, and one doesn't have to be concerned about the that it was used in an inappropriate manner. That was the psak of Rybalski. What about nowadays? We have much more sophisticated coffee machines, the Keurig machines, and all types of get all the names of them now. But talk about Keurig for a minute. A little more familiar. We have them in the OU office as well. We have these machines. The OU, they're kind enough that they supply the coffee pods for the office. And I think a lot of offices are like that, where they'll supply. They supply you with different varieties of coffee. A person wants a decaf or a regular or a tea or whatever else it is. If a person were to look through the different varieties and sees that they only have kosher varieties, okay? I mean, if they see that they're offering there are some non-kosher coffee. For instance, the Hakokos, I believe, do not have ashkacha, and they are questionable. If it was used, one should kasher the machines. So if it happened in one's home, that is. So what happens if one sees that they do have? Let's take that case first. A person sees that they do have some of the Hakokos as well, which are not certified and one should not be using. Then you have a question. Can I use the coffee machine? So really, it would be better not to use the coffee machine in such a situation, because on any given day, probably the Hakokos are used. You assume that the machine is used every single day, and therefore, if the Hakoko is not kosher, the machine becomes non-kosher. Why is the machine becoming kosher? Because the pod sits inside of the, it's placed inside the machine. There's an eruy of water right through. It's not a cliche in this case. The water actually penetrates right through the little pod, flows right through, and then it goes into your cup. So when you place your kosher cup in, your kosher coffee cup in, it'll go through there as well. There is an argument that can be made that these Hakoko is extremely questionable whether they're really not kosher. The OU actually was asked to certify them, and the OU wasn't able to. It wasn't because of the ingredients in it at the time. I can't vouch for the ingredients anymore, but the ingredients were all kosher, but the machine, the dryer that was used to produce these the hot cocos, was used also for non-kosher. So it would have to be kashered out. It would have to be down for 24 hours, and then it would have to go through a kashering before it could be used to produce the hot cocoa. The company who was making these hot cocos wasn't willing to do so. They said it would take too long to be down 24 hours to kosher. It would actually, because of all the cleaning and that we required, it would take more than 2 days of being of downtime. And the company was unwilling. They said they run every day. This is a very big operation they had over there. They said the expense of being down whatever amount of times a year in order to run this would cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars of loss. They couldn't afford to do it. So they rejected the offer. They said they can't do it. That being said, it's possible that that the hot cocoa isn't really non-kosher. We don't really know. I wouldn't recommend someone to drink the coffee from there. If someone did, there is what to rely on. If someone had to, sometimes people feel they're in an awkward situation. I work there every day. I really need a coffee. I can't. There is a logic behind putting through a coffee or putting through a water and using that to run out the machine, to kasher out the machine. And then even though there was no wait of 24 hours in this case, and then using it for a kosher coffee. So sort of making themselves a coffee and discarding it and then taking the second cup. There is a logic behind why that would make sense. It would, again, not be the preferred method in this case, but there is what to rely on if a person does so. That being said, that's only talking about where a person knows that the only non-kosher might be something uncertified, like one of these hot cocos or one of the coffees that are listed, one of the coffees that are provided that are not certified. There are K-cups, though. There are these pods that are made. Campbell's, for instance, makes Keurig pods that are chicken soup in them. Okay? Mamish treif, real chicken soup. and you put them into the machine and you run it like you were running a coffee and you make yourself a cup of soup. I assume most offices do not provide these, but a person might bring them, one of the office people might bring such a thing for lunch. And if there is such a, if a person is concerned that someone in his office might be doing so, then one should not use the machine at all. Then it's like any pot that's used for non-kosher, you can't use it. So a person has to have then a sense of what goes on in their office. Is the machine only used for coffee? Do the people consider using their machine for other drinks, such as a chicken soup? So this has opened up a whole world of, you know, possibilities with these machines. That, you know, it used to be a coffee machine, now it's become a whole lunch meal that can be provided by that. I mean, a lot of people I mentioned this to aren't even aware that, you know, because we would, you know, they obviously don't sell in the kosher stores these things, and I don't know how popular they are, but Campbell's does make them, and someone must be buying them. So, but again, if a person, let's say he knows the workers in his office, they're not, he sees nobody ever seems to be using these, the office provides coffee, and it's only the kosher certified coffee ones that are provided, there are no hot cocos, there are none of the non-certified coffees, then really one could take a coffee from the machine. If a person's in a place where you see what's being provided, then, you know, to be chosher, the question is, do I have to be chosher? Do I have to assume in my mind that maybe something's happening and I didn't know about it, and, you know, even though I looked around and it seems like it's out of the ordinary, do I have to assume that, you know, that it's taken place? The answer is no. If something is so uncommon, then I don't have to, one does not have to be concerned about it. A coffee machine is used for coffee. It's the company provides the coffee, or the coffee that's provided is kosher. Why would a person be bringing in something else, you know, out of the street just to make my machine non-kosher? It's something that's out of the ordinary. You don't have to be suspect for it. Now, some offices, most offices, I think, have disposable cups. They have styrofoam, you know, hot cups. There are places, though, that'll have mugs. They have, they wash them out. They have maybe a dishwasher or something, and they'll have. You could get a coffee in a mug. If they have a mug that you could use, I would not recommend using a ceramic mug. Once it became non-kosher, if it ever did, it'll remain non-kosher forever, and there's no way to kosher ceramic, and it's. It's more of a problem. Even though, like we just explained, if the coffee mugs are only associated with this machine, they're only used for coffee, there wouldn't be a problem. But they're washed out in dishwashers, and there are other, you know, this type of situations. There's usually other things that can make the mugs non-kosher as well. So if there's a ceramic mug, you shouldn't use it. You should use a disposable styrofoam cup. Some places, the office will have a little kitchenette area with different utensils. They'll have a can opener. You can use the can opener. It's not a problem. You can rinse it off first. Just make sure it's clean. It's not a problem. It can be used. If the office has a metal knife, that should not be used, or any other metal utensils should not be used. See, a metal knife could be used to cut sandwiches and cut hot pizza and cut all types of things. And even if it appears clean, even if you are rinse it off, and I'm just going to cut a fruit with it, I'm going to cut an apple, so you would think, what should be the problem? Halacha says you're not allowed to do that. You still need to kosher the knife, even before you cut an apple. There's something called ni'itza, which means to stick it into dirt. This is where the common myth of placing in a flower pot, spoons or something, knives, comes from. It has nothing to do with a flower pot, but it has to do with sticking it into hard dirt 10 times as an abrasive method of cleaning off the knife. And it's not enough to just clean it under warm water, and even if it appears clean, halacha says that there's still to be little bits of residue on the knife, and it needs some sort of a steel wool, something very abrasive to get off the dirt. So little utensils in general should not be used. Okay, let's just turn the topics here a little bit. People bringing in food into work. So generally speaking, people will either they'll bring a bag lunch with them, or they will go out for lunch. If a person brings a bag lunch with them, so obviously they bring their food from home. They could bring hopefully they bring kosher food, but they want it to stay kosher. So if a person puts it into the communal fridge, so the question is that a problem? Is there a question? Do I have to be concerned that maybe someone took something out of my lunch? So the truth is that Chazal were under certain circumstances were concerned. There is a concern, for instance, that a person might have a similar looking lunch bag as you. Other people might bring in also a tuna fish sandwich or something that looks similar, and maybe someone switched lunches with you. They took the wrong bag. Even if a person didn't mean to, the people in the office are not, they're not lahachis. They're not trying to cause a person to, do something wrong. But we're not concerned with. Chazal, we're not concerned that a non-Jew tries lahachis just to get us to do averus. But they are concerned that mistakes happen, or that there might be a switch that's made if someone might benefit from it. So a person, whenever he puts his lunch in his bag, he should make sure that there's some sort of a siman, that he knows, he recognizes that this lunch is his, that he can recognize afterwards. He knows, let's say his sandwich is even, he cuts it in half, cuts it in diagonally. Okay, that would be a siman. They take out my lunch, my sandwich, I see it's cut the way I, if you know that your wife always puts celery with the tuna fish, okay, that could be a siman. I see that the tuna fish is the way that I recognize it. If you use a certain type of a bread, that could be a siman. As long as there's some sort of a tzai, you recognize, you know what the sandwich was that your wife or that you yourself made for you the night before, then it's fine. There's no concern. We're not concerned that somebody tried to make a sandwich that looked just like yours at work and trying to, we don't have to be, we don't assume that people went to great extremes to try to duplicate. Now, if a person doesn't know, let's say a person has a bag lunch and they put it in the fridge and they never looked at it. They have no idea what their spouse made for them for lunch. And they take out the lunch later on and it doesn't even have their name on the bag. And presumably it's theirs because they put it, that's where they put their lunch. Well, that's the type of situation that Chazal are concerned about, where now I take out a lunch from the, maybe I'm the one who's taking the wrong lunch from the fridge. I never knew. She knew never made this for me before, So, but the idea is there should be some sort of a tfiyas ayin. It means a person should have some recognition of what the food is before. So if a person's going to put the food in the lunch, in the fridge, they should look at it, open it up, see what was that was in there. If there's, there's some cookies and there's a sandwich and there's a fruit and whatever, and a salad, so then fine, that's what it is. I put it in there, I can take it out later, and I can be confident that it's the same thing that I'm getting out is what I put in. If a person doesn't know what they're putting in, there should be a siman on the bag. The bag should be, or the bag could be taped up, or there should be something done that it shouldn't be that it shouldn't be switched. In another example where we come to a problem, a person, let's say, is makbid on Chol Yisrael. Okay, so they bring with them a little canister of milk at the beginning of the week. Monday morning, they bring themselves a canister of milk, and they put it in the fridge, and the rest of the office doesn't drink Chol Yisrael. They have regular milk in the fridge for others to use, or people bring their own milk to work, and they have it in canisters. And your canister of milk, your little pint or whatever it is unlocked, is opened in the fridge. There's a concern that other people might say, oh, I see you have the low-fat milk and the office has the regular, and vice versa. I like that type better. And they might take some of your milk and say, yeah, you know what, I feel badly. I took some of their milk. Let me replace it with some of mine. And people we call mora heter. They don't consider this to really be stealing. I replaced it after all. And it's, with no harm done. You have a whole canister, a little bit I took, I replaced it, and, nothing, no harm done. Well, for a person who's makbid on Chol Yisrael, that the person mixed back in, you would have rather they just took the milk and left, they've just taken it. Don't do me any favors. But the person feels, they feel badly, they'll put in a little bit of milk back in. And that little bit of milk will be a problem.
according to the Shulchan Aruch, according to Rama, if milk gets mixed with non-Chol Yisrael milk, gets mixed into Chol Yisrael, you need 60 times in order to make it, in order that it should be bottled, which it probably will not be. The person took a little bit in their replaced it. You're not going to have 60 times in your canister against that milk. So, I don't know that happened, but this would be another scenario where Chazal would say that you have no way of guaranteeing that your milk was unadulterated, that it's as it was when you put it in. So in this type of case, you should put some sort of a seal on your milk. You should put a piece of tape and write your name on it or something, some sort of a way that nobody would take it. Or if they did, let's say they didn't realize and they ripped it open, oh, whoops, I ripped the tape. Then when you come back later, you'll see that the tape was ripped and then you'll know not to use your milk. But if you didn't, then Chazal say you cannot use it. Even though it seems far-fetched that it was used, it's a loy plug, what we call a low plug. They didn't make any distinction. Chazal said, it doesn't matter if the situation of this, as long as there's a plausible possibility that such a thing could happen, and you could come up with a scenario in your head about why such a thing would happen, then it's a problem. You left for the day, right? The workers, whoever stays, knows that you're not coming back. They know they have time. They could take the milk out of the fridge, use it, replace it, and put it back, and you'll never know. So in such a situation, even if it didn't happen, or you have no reason to think that it, you have no reason to know that it happened, it looks the same, or you're not permitted to use the milk anymore. So again, if people leave all types of things in the fridge, a person might leave ketchup in the fridge, right? So let's say he likes to buy fries from downstairs, and he has his own bottle of ketchup. So again, now in this type of situation, I don't think there's a concern that a person would open up your ketchup and try to put some other ketchup in. Okay, and if he did, he probably is using us to cover for your ketchup. But there is a concern that a person might borrow your ketchup. I'm sure he doesn't mind, and he would end up smearing it against his hot dog or his hamburger or whatever else he might have bought that isn't kosher, and that would make the front of it. So in such a situation, if a person left their ketchup there, they would then should rinse off the front of the bottle. They would, if a person didn't leave it sealed, they would have to be concerned that it was used. So each case, you'd have to try to think up what would be the possibility of how it could be used, and then best is to try to avoid the situation altogether, leave it sealed, put a big sign on it, do not touch, and with some sort of a cap on it, some sort of a seal. One of the most common questions we get asked at the OU has to do with Starbucks. Okay, so it becomes like this $64,000 question. Can a person go out to Starbucks? Can you get a coffee there? Should you not go? There's no one right answer to this question. It depends. In fact, Starbucks sells many different products, many different types of coffees, many different ways it can be used. And I understand that there's a whole website of kosher Starbucks or something where people post all types of ideas of what you could buy and So I'm just going to talk more generally. Starbucks, what are the issues there? Okay, it is a restaurant. They serve or food to go. They give you out a coffee in a disposable, styrofoam cup. But they also serve sandwiches. They have an oven there where they'll heat up the sandwiches. They have all types of utensils that they have for taking the sandwiches in and out of the ovens. They have tongs and flippers and all types of items. There's a plate that the food sits on inside of the oven. Okay. And there's a dishwasher, and everything, all the parts, pieces that we of Starbucks get sanitized multiple times a day in that dishwasher. It's a corporate rule of Starbucks that everything has to be sanitized. They have a whole schedule of how often they have to do so. So that means that every day, there's never such a thing as an Eina Ben Yomo, meaning that things weren't used in 24 hours at Starbucks. Everything is there every single day. This dishwasher is used every day with the non-kosher equipment, and it's used with there are parts that go with the coffee that also end up in the dishwasher. I'll give one example. There is a if a person buys a drink or a latte where they steam the milk in a, there's like a metal wand that goes down, and you put the cup with the metal, there's a metal cup that they place there, and it boils up the milk. So there's a, you use boiled milk in this type of a drink. That metal cup goes into the dishwasher. It goes into the dishwasher together with whatever else is in the store at the time. So it's not that much, but this plate and the flipper and the tongs all go in, and they have a few of them, you know, so they could afford to use up one while they're, you know, washing the other. And they're going to go in, they're going to be washing the dishwasher. The dishwashers can get very hot. There is soap in the dishwasher. So people say, oh, soap. So then that makes everything pogum. Okay, that's true. While the soap is in the dishwasher. But the there's going to be a final sanitation cycle, which will not have any soap at the end, where they're washing away all the soap and they're sanitizing the dishes. And the dishes weren't kashered through this washing. These are things that go into an oven. The way to kasher them is with libun, not with hagala. Okay, so even if you viewed somehow this dishwasher as some sort of a hagala process, it wouldn't be sufficient to kasher any of these machines, any of these utensils. So really, at some point, you can end up with all these utensils being cooked together in a giant pot of a dishwasher. And it seemingly is a problem, okay? That being said, there are a lot of drinks that you could get at a Starbucks. If you want to buy a plain brewed coffee, for instance, at a Starbucks, some of the ones that we went to and we discussed with the managers over there about how they're made, it seems that there's either none of it goes in the dishwasher, or sometimes there's one part of it. There's a basket called a brew basket. That brew basket might go into the dishwasher, but even if it does, because of the way it's used, it would not cause a problem with the coffee. The coffee would still be permitted. It'd be based on bittel, and you know, again, getting back into the kashrus and difficult situations, it's already been made, and the coffee is permitted. So if a person wants to go to a Starbucks and they know, you know, what they're ordering just a plain brewed coffee, and then they want to put a flavor in, and they know what the flavor is because they see it says has a kasher symbol on it. They ask to see if it has, you know, I think they have them all lined up, all the different flavors. You could ask to see the bottle, and they want to put the cream into their coffee, and they ask to see the canister for that too, and they see that it has that it's a kosher, or they know which one it is. It's one that they're familiar with. So then, technically speaking, you could get a coffee, that type of coffee. If a person wanted to get one of these lattes that are steamed, so then it's a problem from many angles. It's a problem because, like we mentioned, that canister, that cup, that metal cup, it went into the dishwasher together with the non-kosher. It's a problem because that coffee is not made in advance. It's made to order. When you come into the store and you ask them, you order that coffee, they'll make it right then for you. And even if we were to say that it would be bottled, you're not allowed to ask a non-Jew to cook for you in a non-kosher cup, a non-kosher pot, even if the pot is what we call an Eina Ben Yomo, even if it would be. Even if the pot was not used in 24 hours, and therefore the food cooked in it would technically be kosher, one is not permitted, just like one is not permitted in their own home, to use a non-kosher pot, even if it wasn't used 24 hours, you have to kasher it first. Similarly, one is not permitted to ask a non-Jew to cook for them in that in a non-kosher pot as well. And by ordering this coffee, you are, in essence, asking the non-Jew to cook for you in this non-kosher cup. So, therefore, anything that needs to be made to order, I'm not familiar with all the drinks that they have in the Starbucks, but that would be a general rule of thumb. Anything that needs to be made to order, I would avoid, because it's very likely that there's something involved in that process that had some sort of is going to rely somehow on bittel. And you're not allowed to rely on bittel if you're asking the non-Jew to do it for you or to do it yourself. A person's not allowed to be mevatel iser. They can't nullify non-kosher, even though technically speaking, right, the non-kosher becomes nullified. The food might be permitted to be eaten. Still, it is forbidden to do so. It is forbidden to ask a non-Jew to do so on your behalf as well. Drinks that were already made, in general, would be permitted. So a coffee where they already brew it, you don't come in and they start brewing your coffee for you. You come in, they already have a whole machine full of brewed coffee. So then those type of drinks are permitted. Now, I would just add you know, just for full disclosure, that Rebelsky Zitzel was asked the question about buying drinks at Starbucks. It was a long discussion that we had with him about this, about these points. And his recommendation was, again, it's not necessarily for everybody, it depends on the situation, but his recommendation was, don't go into Starbucks. And he said, it's too complicated. You're going to tell people this type of drink you could get and this type of drink you can't get. And people are going to have to start looking at the containers and seeing what it has in OU or it has a different hafshar and what's kosher. He said, it's a bad chinuch. We tell people that, you know, we make things, you know, too complicated. And you say, oh, I saw my friend goes to Starbucks. I can go to Starbucks and you know, gets to the next issue or to discuss of Marasayim. Which, not that Starbucks is Marasayim. Again, there are plenty of kosher things you could buy there. It's just, he thought that it was a bad chinuch. But there are circumstances, certainly, where a person feels they have to go. I know a lot of people meet clients at Starbucks. They're not in a situation where they can, you know, they invite the guy to come to the Starbucks and then they sit there not drinking anything, you know. But he asked me to come here, you know. So it's sort of become the safe zone. In the kosher world, is that of all the places to go, this is much better than a lot of the others. So, I'm not telling people they shouldn't go to Starbucks. I would just say, be careful if a person goes. Make sure that you know which flavors are kosher. If you can get a flavored drink, make sure you know what you're doing. And I would recommend getting those drinks which were already prepared and not getting something, not one of the drinks that you have to ask them to prepare for you. Unless you know that is... I think there are some websites which tell you which exactly down to the very specific of what you can and can't do. But if you don't know all the specifics, this would be a very good rule of thumb to go by. So which brings up the question of, just in general, about Marasayim. Okay, back to we started with this, you know, this poor fellow has to go to these non-kosher restaurants all the time for meetings. So, truthfully speaking, that itself is a question of that is a problem of Marasayim. Person shouldn't, Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about the person, is he allowed to go into a non-kosher restaurant? He's very thirsty, it's a very hot day, he's uncomfortable. So he says if he's very uncomfortable, he says then it is permitted. You know, Marasayim is overridden by if a person is in tzar, if a person is in great discomfort. But if a person is not in great discomfort, then person should not go into a non-kosher restaurant and buy a soda, okay? Even though, really, right, I'm buying something kosher, why can't the person just assume that I'm doing everything right? The answer is because it looks very suspicious. You see a guy walking into a McDonald's, especially if there are other stores nearby you could have gone into a convenience store and bought a soda. Why is he going into the restaurant? And the reason he's going in is because he has a meeting there. He has a client that he has to meet. So the one recommendation that's given is, when it comes to Marasayim, one of the ways to get around the problem of Marasayim is you make a hecker. Okay, and Shulchan Aruch describes a scenario where they used to cook meat with almond milk. Okay, it was some sort of a delicacy they used to make, a Purim, and the other times, you know, And it's a problem of Marasayim. If a person sees you cooking the almond milk with meat, it looks like you're cooking meat and milk. And that's obviously not permitted. So the Shulchan Aruch says that the Eitzah, the suggestion of how to get around this problem, is that you should put some almonds around the pot. So a person sees the milk cooking with the meat, and he sees the almonds, they'll put two and two together. And that's a little subtle hint. Not many people won't necessarily figure out why what those almonds are doing there, why there's some almonds next to the pot, what that means. But enough people will understand. Somebody wants to think about it hard enough, they'll realize, oh yeah, that must be, that's almond milk. And that's probably why he put the almonds there. So the answer is, if a person wants to go into a restaurant, they have to make a hecker. What is a hecker? How do you make a hecker? Put some almonds next to me when I walk into the store, what do you do? So one suggestion that's made is I'll give an extreme example, and then we'll take it to a more normal example. If a person walked into the store holding a plumber's bag, you know, an electrician, full of different pipes and equipment, everyone would recognize right away that he's going in to fix the pipes. And no one would think he's going in to buy a meal. If he walks in carrying a bag of pipes and, you know, a Roto-Rooter or something, so everyone realizes that he's going in, and then there wouldn't be any Marasayim. That would be a hacker. That would be an example of a way that everyone would know. So how do you, a guy's going into a business meeting, he should make it clear that it's obvious he's going into a business meeting. He should bring a briefcase with him. He should bring a, you know, some sort of a folder full of papers, you know, and things. He walks in, so it looks like he's not going to have lunch. It looks like he's going to make some sort of a presentation. The way, if a person goes in without any papers, he's just going to lunch, because that's what they're really doing. So then that's the problem. That's the place, that's the case where it's, where it looks like he's going to have lunch there. And even though there really is no presentation, he should still bring his briefcase along anyways. He should go in, make it look like he's having some sort of a meeting. And that way, someone sees him going in, will know, yeah, this is what we do in New York. We have to go to meetings in these non-kosher restaurants. So that itself would be a hacker. One example of where it is a problem, and Schefter held that this should not be done, is some people want the opposite. They want to go to a meeting and they don't want it to stick out at all, that they want it to look like they feel they belong there. And they order the restaurants that will provide them with a fancy meal set on china with silverware. It gets sent in advance to the restaurant, to the non-kosher restaurant, double wrapped like we described. It gets heated up for them and brought out. Well, you know, the guy, all the plastics and all the coverings and everything is removed, and he sits down and eats his meal together with everybody else at the table. Maybe his food is a little different, but everybody probably at the table has different, you know, ordered different foods, so it doesn't look really out of the ordinary. It's China looks almost the same as what the people there have, and anyone walking by would think he's eating non-kosher food in a non-kosher restaurant. So that would be a prime example of Marzayin. So, but if a person goes in and he says, he goes in with his briefcase and he orders himself fruit, preferably it should not be cut up, because once it's cut with non-kosher knives, you have a question on the fruit as well. But he orders himself a fruit and says, can you have a plastic knife with that? He'll get himself a soda. And he sits at the meeting and he looks silly, but that's what we do. So that would be the way to get around the problem of Marisayan. There are many more topics to discuss that have to do with kashrut of the workplace. I'm running out of time here. I'd like to open up the floor if anyone has questions. We could discuss the questions that people have that are relevant. Yes.
So in terms of, if I could stretch it to the house, in terms of a microwave, so do you need to have a separate meat and dairy microwaves in the house? Or can you, or use the microwave for meat or for dairy? Or can you use the other but, you know, covered with plastic?
A very good question, yeah. So again, best would be to have two microwaves, a milk and a flesh microwave. A lot of people don't have room in their kitchen to have two microwaves, or they find that it's, for whatever reason, it's not practical. Yes, you could do that. You could designate my microwave for one or the other. I'll designate it. This is my milk microwave. And, you know, once in a while I have some deflations, I want to warm it up. Then you could warm it up in the deflations microwave, in the milk microwave, if you double wrap it. It's permitted. It's a question of, you know, each preference of a person. You know, so, some people, your wife sees you doing that, she'll start yelling at you. You know, we don't do this in our house. You know, oh, but the rabbi at the shir said, you know, no. So I think, in a lechatchila environment, best is to have two separate microwaves. If you can't, you know, heat it up a different way. But you know, from a halacha standpoint, it's perfectly legitimate to heat it up if you double wrap it. So you could heat up your fleishigs in a milk microwave if you put two wrappings against it, around it. Again, in case it does burst, so then you have to call the rabbi. Anybody else? Yes?
Let's say you want it fruit and you cut up fruit. Can you assume that the knives used for fruit are only used for fruit?
Okay, that's a very good question. It's also very applicable in a supermarket. Okay, you go to the supermarket, they sell cut up fruit. So in halacha, we find this. They make a distinction in this case. If it's in a supermarket, okay, it's not what we're talking about supermarket, but they're talking about if you have a large amount of fruit that were cut up at one time, then you could. And we assume that even if they used a non-kosher knife, and even if it was greasy and dirty, the amount of grease that there is on the knife would get used up in the first few cuts that are made. So let's say, I don't know, first 10, 20 cuts that are made of fruit, it would clean up the knife. If they're doing a large amount, so they're cutting up, 100 watermelons, something like that at a supermarket, so then we assume then now that 90 of the watermelons are fine and only 10 of them are not fine. Okay, well, so now what? Halacha says that you go after rov. You could assume that if I'm going to pick a watermelon, I'm picking from the 90%. So the same thing in your case with the cruise. We'll assume on cruises, they're serving hundreds of people at once. They're not serving a special order of fruit just for you, but they've made, they have 2,000 guests or something on the cruise at one time, and everyone's eating lunch at the same time. So there's a tremendous amount. They probably have a special kitchen just for cutting up fruit. And they probably have special knives for cutting up the fruit and that type of... So in that type of example, one could use the fruit, because one could assume that it was done in very, very large volume. If the knife is being used in a different context, though, let's say I go into a restaurant and I order a cut-up fruit, where they're going to now do it just for me, okay? They don't have a large amount of fruit in the restaurant. They get in customers and they make to order whatever you order. You say you want to cut up melons and things. They'll sit there cutting up for you a few melons, and they'll prepare it for you, or a pineapple or something. They'll carve it out for you. So then that's where you have to be concerned that maybe the knife was not a special fruit knife, or it came into some dirty, it was used in some other way. There's also a concern, even if the knives, let's say at this type of a place, they have a special fruit knife, the gloves that the workers use, or hopefully they're using gloves, they might have previously touched meats and seafood or who knows what, and they might not be so careful to change their gloves before they handle your portion of fruit. If it's you go to a cruise and they have a huge table full of fruit, you wouldn't have that concern, because it would be all, when they prepared this, even if we said that when they started their hands were dirty, it for sure did not contaminate the entire batch if it's a large amount. So yeah, so if it's, you'd have to, a person would have to put into context, what is the scenario? They're talking about a small amount, or they're talking about a large amount. Anybody else? Okay, so I think we basically are out of time anyways. So I thank you everybody for coming.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Hagala for the soup in the curtain. You might be genius or rely on Hagala for that.